Okay, good evening. Last week we began our conversation about what we are calling halachic men, which is basically an attempt to analyze the life and times of the figures who formed the halacha. And last week we focused on the Beis Yosef, on Rabbi Yosef Karo, who lived between 1488 and 1575. And the most salient point regarding Rabbi Yosef Karo's halachic work is that he had two works. There's the Beis Yosef, which is the more expansive work, where he tried to present all of the different positions, all the different shitos based on the Torah. And then later in life, the Beis Yosef, after he's in Israel already, writes the Shulchan Aruch, which is a shorter work, an apodictic work. It just quotes the dinim. It's almost like the baseball rule book we said, right? You do this, you do that, etc. And the Shulchan Aruch basically summed up halacha according to the Beis Din that the Beis Yosef has. In other words, the Beis Yosef is assuming, that Rabbi Yosef Karo is assuming that there are three major authorities. There is the Rif, the Rambam, and the Rush. And based on two of these three authorities, two is the majority of three. That's something I learned in elementary school way back when. But if two of the three authorities agree with one position, that will be the position that the halacha follows. If not, so then the halacha will always follow the majority. That's basically the opinion of the Beis Yosef in his Beis Yosef, and that's the way it ends up being codified largely in Shulchan Aruch. This is the basics. Of course, all rules that are based on basics have many exceptions. We noted last week Professor Twersky's article about the Shulchan Aruch, where Professor Twersky effectively said, well, I have 50 cases or 70 cases where the Shulchan Aruch quotes multiple opinions. And that's true, but those are sort of the exceptions that prove the rule. Effectively, the goal of Shulchan Aruch is just to tell us, this is what we do. Now, Shulchan Aruch is a controversial work. Okay? People were going to kill each other over whether or not we accept the Shulchan Aruch. Right? When the Shulchan Aruch came out, when it was published first in 1565, there were wars about whether or not to accept this book. And there were many different reasons why some did not want to accept the Shulchan Aruch. Tonight, when we look at the Ramah, when we look at Rav Moshe Israelis, we're going to be focusing on the Ramah from the context of how he fits in together with the opponents to Shulchan Aruch. There is a group of opponents to Shulchan Aruch. Look at the first page over here. I give you. There's Rav Shlomo Luria, the Maharsha, the Lavush. Right? These are opponents of Shulchan Aruch. Now, we are not necessarily going in chronological order. Some of these, the Lavush especially, is a student of the Ramah. Okay? So we're going to be talking about the Ramah after the Lavush, but we're doing it this way for a reason, because I want to describe for you some of the reasons why people are opposed to Shulchan Aruch, and put the Ramah in that context. Okay? That's the agenda. Everyone got it? Fine. So the first authority that we are talking about is Rabbi Shlomo Luria. Rabbi Shlomo Luria, it says, lived from 1510 until 1573. Rabbi Shlomo Luria was a cousin of the Ramah. Rabbi Shlomo Luria, the Maharshal, that's who he is. He is a cousin of the Ramah. The Ramah's grandfather was named Rabbi Yechiel Luria, his mother's father. Rabbi Yechiel Luria is also the grandfather of the Maharshal. Okay? So they are cousins. They also became mechutanim later in life. In other words, the Ramah's daughter married a son of the Maharshal. So they are related. Good? Fine. That is something that is interesting. Maharshal did not like Shulchan Aruch. Maharshal felt Shulchan Aruch is a terrible work. Now, I have quoted here for you, this is a quotation from Edward Fram, from Ted Fram's book, Ideals Face Reality. He's a historian of Polish Jewry. This is one of the few books that Chaim Soloveitchik actually likes in the world. So, He writes as follows. Luria rejected contemporary Talmudic and legal methodology. He dismissed the then current belief that legal opinions of earlier generations were almost sacrosanct. Luria maintained that his generation had just as equal access to knowledge as those that came before it. He believes it's incumbent upon scholars in each generation to comb the sources from their Talmudic beginnings through the Tosafists to their own day, analyzing and weighing each matter and all opinions before coming to a well-considered conclusion. In other words, the Maharshal writes books called the Yamshel Shlomo. The Yamshel Shlomo is a very long-winded approach to halacha. His job is that he is going to call the sugya and find out who is right. And he doesn't feel that he has a monopoly on determining who's right. He understands, the Maharshal feels, that every Rav, who paskins a shayla, has to determine who is right by going through all the sugyas. So I study whatever is out there, and I see, well, it seems like X is right. So far, so good? And therefore, the Maharshal is opposed to Shulchan Aruch, because Shulchan Aruch is a book that I pull off the shelf, and Shulchan Aruch says, we paskin whatever. We paskin that you put on the tefillin shel yad sitting down. And Tefillin Shel are standing up, right? So the Maharshal would say, whoa, 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 who says that's correct? Who says that's correct? Let's go through the sugya. Let's see, all brachos, standing, sitting, go through the whole discourse to arrive at the conclusion. That is the Maharshal. Now, it happens that the Maharshal had a bias. The Maharshal's bias, which he writes in the Hakdama of the Yamshel Shlomo, the introduction of the Yamshel Shlomo to Chulin, which I didn't print out because it's not found in Bar Ilan, but the Maharshal basically says, my job is to tell you who is right. And you know who right is? Who's right? If there's a dispute between Tosis and the Rambam, who's right? Tosis is right. If there's a dispute between Tosis and the Ramban, who's right? The Ramban is right. Right? Basically, Nachmanides beats Tosfos. Tosfos beats Maimonides, right? And everybody beats the Rif and the Rosh. Why is that? Because the Maharshal felt that Tosfos and those who learn the same way as Tosfos were the only ones who knew how to understand the Talmudic passage. They engaged in what is called dialectic. Dialectic means I don't just study this sugya at hand, right? When I study a Gemara in Chulin, I say, okay, the same sugya appears in Brachos, right? And there's a bit of a contradiction between these sugyas. Now let's try to reconcile this contradiction. Dialectic is a method of systematically looking for contradictions and trying to reconcile them. The Rambam didn't do dialectic. The Rif didn't do dialectic. Tosfos did dialectic. The Ramban did dialectic. People who did dialectic, says the Maharshal, knew what they were doing. People who didn't do dialectic didn't know what they were doing. And therefore, when the Maharshal says, I'm going to go to the bottom of every sugya and try to find out who's right, you know who's going to be right? Tosfos, Ramban. They will be right, and everybody else is wrong. That is the approach that the Maharshal takes. Needless to say, Shulchan Aruch is a terrible book, according to the Maharshal, and the Maharshal never accepted Shulchan Aruch. That's why he wrote his Yamshel Shlomo, but even the Yamshel Shlomo, he did not fail, should be a binding treatise. Yeah?
Did he speak about his reaction to the Yisro's
Yeah, so in... where are those pages? Yes. So, in the introduction to the Yamshel Shlomo on Chulin, he writes, and I could quote you, V'chein haya ki chadash mikarov ba liyadeinu sefer v'chibor she'asa Reb Yosef Kara al Haturim. V'hera kama chidushim misvarim mekadmonim shelo hayu biyadayim biyamim she'avru, u'tshuvot nachriyot v'chidushim, etc. In other words, the Beis Yosef wrote this book, and he's not missing anything. He uncovers all of the sources. Svaras Hakeres is a Hebrew word saying Beich Svara. He used stomach logic rather than brain logic. Right? It's right. Gut feeling. Gut feeling, which he feels, Berov Pa'amim he argued against the Kabbalah, Asher Kibaonu V'Nahagu Ad Hena, the Kabbalah that he means, based on what he says in the five pages beforehand, is that we follow Tosus and the Ramban, because Tosus and the Ramban, he says, is Gadol B'Chochma U'B'Minyan from the Rambam and the Rif. Gadol B'Chochma U'B'Minyan means that Tosus and the Ramban are wiser, right? And there are more of them. Okay, there are more of them. You only got like one Rif and one Rambam over there, and I got like thousands of Tosis. So they are Gadol B'Chochma U'B'Minyan. That is the approach that the Maharshal takes. Maharshal hates Shulchan Aruch. Good? Now, it happens that Maharshal also hated the Rambam in later years. The Maharshal and the Rambam we mentioned, this is just an aside, but tonight our focus will be the Rambam. Maharshal and the Rambam are cousins, right? That's what we said. In earlier years, the Maharshal and the Rambam got along with each other very nicely, and they wrote nicely to each other. They played nice. The Maharshal sent a shayla to the Rambam about some topic in Shreifis, and the Rambam responded to the Maharshal. But as that dispute heated up, and they began not to see eye to eye with each other, so then, if you look in Simon Hei Vav and Zayin of Tshuvas HaRambam, you have this back and forth between the Rambam and the Maharshal, things got bitter. The Rambam at one point says, by the way, what I'm saying is absolutely logical because Aristotle agrees with me. So that sent the Maharshal ballistic. He goes nuts. He goes, you're quoting a goy! Right, what are you doing? You can't do that. This is holy Torah. You can't quote goyim. Right? So then the Rambam writes back and says, oh, it's not that I read Aristotle, heaven forbid, right? The Rambam quotes Aristotle. Oh, okay. Right? But apparently the Rambam made some diktuk error when he wrote this to the Maharshal. And the Maharshal says, well, you know, maybe the Rambam says that, but you don't know what you're talking about because in your sentence you messed up Zohar and Akeva and Yachid and Rabim and you don't know any diktuk. So the Rambam writes back and says, you're right, I don't know any diktuk, but I know Torah. And that's more important. And this became a whole dispute between... Now, it seems from this dispute that they hated each other, yet when the Rambam dies, the Maharshal writes about the Rambam a take-off of a line that was said about the Rambam before him, Mi Moshe ad Moshe lo kam ke Moshe. That line was said about the Rambam, about Maimonides. Maimonides dies in 1204. Maharshal appropriates that line about the Rambam. So there is some interesting stuff for historians to uncover here about the relationship between the Maharshal and the Rambam. We will leave it. Okay? Other people who are opposed to Shulchan Aruch are the Maharsha. Maharsha is, right, and this is not from Wikipedia, this is from the Bar Ilan biography. Maharsha is Rabbi Samuel Eliezer, the son of Rabbi Judah Halevi Edels. He is called Edels because he was supported by his shviger, by his mother-in-law, who was known as Edel, and then hence he took the name Edels. There are historians, by the way, who say that traditionally Jewish society was a matriarchy, and hence many of the last names are women's names. Reb Moshe Rivkish, Reb Shmuel Edels. This is something I first heard from Shol Stempfer. There's what to think about. Okay, so this is Maharsha. Maharsha wrote a major commentary on Shas. Right? He wrote two halves, Chidushei Agados and Chidushei Halachos, both Chidushim on the halachic portions of Shas and Chidushim on the agadic portions of Shas. And the Maharsha, in the comment in Maseches Sota, he writes as follows. Ubedoros halalo. You see it? In these generations, Osan Shemorin Halacha Mitoch Shulchan Aruch. Those people who paskin Halacha out of this new book, Shulchan Aruch. Remember, he's born 1555, like half a step away from the reigning of Shulchan Aruch. These who paskin Halacha out of Shulchan Aruch, Harehin Eim Yodim Ta'a Ha'inyan Shol Kol Davar. They don't know the reasons behind it. Imlo Yudaktiko Mitchilo B'davar Mitoch HaTalmud Shu Shimush Tamidei Chachamim. If they're not going to learn the Gemara, they're not going to know the reasons, and only Talmidei Chachamim do that. V'ta'os nafa b'hora osam, and they paskin wrong. V'harehim b'chlal mivalei olam. And the people who paskin out of Shulchan Aruch are destroyers of the world. These are fighting words, gentlemen, ladies. Right? This means, right, that you paskin out of Shulchan Aruch, you are destroying the planet. That's bad. Right? My son would think that's good, because he likes bombing. But most of us think that it's a bad thing to destroy the world. The Maharsha is opposed to the Shulchan Aruch, because you do not know the reasons of it. You don't know the reasons. The Lavush, similarly, the Lavush is a student of the Ramah, lived 1530 to 1612. The Lavush... Lavush is a rabbi in Prague, and that was his major rabbinic position and many other positions. The Lavush writes that he got this book, the Shulchan Aruch. He got the book, the Shulchan Aruch, from the Mechaber and the Ramah. It's written very short. They set up the table. It's called Shulchan Aruch. Right? It's a set table. It's a table set with many delicacies. But it's eating it like, what's tafel beli melach? It's bland without salt. The food is not salted. Even though all Talmid Chachamim will have their own taste that they apply to it. Your food needs salt. Halachas require reasons. Now, the Lavush is saying a little different than the Maharsha. Maharsha is saying there's no reasons and no one can paskin without reasons unless you're Talmud Chacham. The Lavush is saying that also, and the Lavush is saying, you know what? Therefore, I need reasons, because a halacha without a reason is like food without salt. There's no taste. And even though the Talmidei Chachamim will find the proper taste for the food, but average people won't. And the Shulchan Aruch, he's assuming, is supposed to be written for the average people, not just the Talmidei Chachamim. Last week we saw that Rabbi Yosef Karo seemed to say that there are two audiences for Shulchan Aruch. It's for Talmidei Chachamim to review, and for the average person to know the basics, right? He says, well, the average person's going to know the basics, but just like if I read the baseball rule book, and I see when there's a runner on first and second, there's a fly pop to the infield. Do I apply the infield fly rule or not? It's a very serious shaila. I don't remember the answer, right? But these types of things, if you don't really know the reason behind it, it's meaningless, no? So when the issue comes up, you'll look into it. If you're a Talmud Chacham, you'll be able to find it, probably. But, says the Lavush, he's not convinced people will be able to find it. Therefore, the Lavush wrote a work called the Lavush. His name was Mordechai, and he based on the Psukim in Esther, Mordechai Yatzo Melefnei HaMelech B'Lavush Malachus, Techeles V'chor, Terezahav, right? So Lavush Malchus is his book on Orachayim, etc. So the Lavush writes a work where he gives you the dinim and he gives you the reasons. And traditionally, in certain European communities, between Mincha and Ma'ariv, the rabbi would teach Lavush, just like in some communities they teach Aruch HaShulchan, because there are reasons that are given, it's exciting. But it's not like just teaching Shulchan Aruch, which is really dry and boring if you teach Shulchan Aruch without the commentaries. So now, let's just go back where we have. People are opposed to Shulchan Aruch for a few different reasons, right? There are some who are opposed to all codification. That would be the Maharshal. Maharshal says, you can't give me a shortened version because everyone has to pass in Shaila by going into all the details, right? And you have to analyze it yourself. No halacha work could possibly exist for the Maharshal. Then there are others who are not opposed to all codification, but they're opposed to works of codification that do not give reasons. That would be the Maharsha and the Lavush. So far, so good? Yeah. So he's talking about, yes, so the Shulchan Aruch that the Lavush is talking about is Shulchan Aruch with the Ramah. The Ramah shortly, there was one printing of Ramah on its own. After that, every printing of the Ramah is together with the Shulchan Aruch. And he says, it doesn't help because you don't have reasons. And for the Lavush, what's critical is the reasons. The Lavush is a Talmud of the Ramah, and he didn't like what his Rebbe did because the Rebbe didn't give reasons. That's right. Now, where are we now in the world. Which country are we located in? We're in Poland, mostly. Maharshal, Maharsha, Lwów learned in Poland, then he went to Prague. Everyone is in Poland, correct? Rama is also a Polish Jew. Right? So, what we are having at this point is a conversation about halachic texts that are written in the Ottoman Empire and in Sfat, and are making their way back to Poland, right? And people are deciding, do we accept this work or don't we accept this work? That's the conversation that's going on. I want to just spend 2 minutes about Polish Jewry in general, and then we will introduce the Ramah, and then we will talk about why the Ramah did not like Shulchan Aruch, and what the Ramah did about it. Remember, the Maharsha kvetched. The Marshal showed you how you should do things, even though it's not a halachic work. The Lwów wrote his own halachic work. Right? Three different approaches about what to do about this book called Shulchan Aruch that I don't like. The Ramah is going to have his own approach, which is that he will add notes to this book he doesn't like, called the Shulchan Aruch, which paradoxically, in the great paradox of Jewish history, the Ramah is an opponent of Shulchan Aruch, but he caused Shulchan Aruch to become accepted. Right? Because the Ramah is writing his notes on the Shulchan Aruch, that's why Shulchan Aruch now becomes the accepted halachic text. That is the history. But let's talk about Poland for a minute. When did Jews first come to Poland? Anyone know? So it's pretty easy to figure out, because around 50 years ago, there was a book written called A Tausend Jahr Yiddish in Poland. Okay, so those of you who could translate, that means 1,000 years of Yiddish in Poland, around 50 years ago. Jews came to Poland around the time, a little bit before, and around the time of the First Crusade. Okay, so Jews were in Poland for a very long time. Right? Now, how do I know this? I don't know exactly when the first Jews showed up in Poland, but I do know when the kings of Poland gave the Jews their first land rights. We have land rights of Jews in the Kingdom of Poland from the 1230s, 1240s. I forgot which king, but we have this Menachem Elon in his book HaMishpat Ivri, traces this. The historian Balaban is the main historian of this period. He traces this. There is a lot of evidence that Jews lived in Poland, right? At least from the 13th century, but probably way beforehand. Now, who are the rabbis in Poland at this time? Does anyone know any rabbi in Poland in the 13th century, in the 14th century, in the 15th century? Anyone? You're not going to know anyway. You know why? Because there weren't any. As far as we know, there were no rabbis in Poland at this time. There was actually one Sephardic rabbi that some historian dug up. Like, who... Whatever. A Sephardi in Poland. It's like a joke almost, no? But the fact is...
Came from someplace.
Right. The fact is that we don't have rabbis in Poland. The first rabbi in Poland that we know of moved to Poland in the year 1492. His name was Reb Yaakov Palak. He established a yeshiva in Krakow. Now, he didn't really establish a yeshiva in Krakow, because anyone who learns how to be Masadar a get knows that you never wrote Gittin in Krakow. Because Jews weren't allowed to live in Krakow. Right? Jews lived in Kazmierz. Kazmierz Masa de Yasin HaVisla van HaVilga. Right? That's the official get in Shulchan Aruch. Is in Kazmierz, which is basically in Krakow, but it's a small district of Krakow. And they'd write Kazmierz in Gittin, not Krakow. Okay, that's the story. Now, Rabbi Yaakov Palak has a yeshiva in Krakow, Kazmierz. Good? Rabbi Yaakov Palak wrote absolutely nothing. We know he existed, but he wrote absolutely nothing. Rabbi Yaakov Palak had a student known as Rabbi Shalom Shachna. Rabbi Shalom Shachna wrote, ready? Absolutely nothing. Okay? We know he existed, but he wrote nothing. That is Reb Shalom Shachna and Reb Yaakov Palach. These are the first two rabbis in Poland that we know. Reb Shalom Shachna actually was appointed. You see, Poland is also very important because Poland is the one community in Ashkenazic Jewry where the local courts, where the Bat Din had authority. The government said, you Bezdin can do stuff like kill people. If you want to know where a local Bezdin actually killed people, look in Poland in the 16th century. To be a rabbi in Poland was very powerful. Reb Shalom Shachna is the rabbi of Gans, Little Poland. Apparently there's Big Poland and Little Poland. Where exactly they drew the line, I don't know. Little Poland had its capital in Lublin. Big Poland had its capital in Krakow. Reb Shalom Shachna is in Lublin, capital of Little Poland. That is the story. Now,
did they kill?
Rama. Yeah, they killed people. Yeah. That's for a different year, a different time, okay? That's coming attractions, but maybe a different summer. Now, the Rama is a student of Reb Shalom Shachna. Right? So Rama is third generation rabbi in Poland. Some claim that not based on a text that I have in front of you. Darkei Moshe HaKotzer in Yerideya Simin Kuf Yud. We'll talk about what Darkei Moshe is in a few minutes. Darkei Moshe is a work by the Rama. Alkein Omer Lecha Sha'emes Hu Mashatirisli Hagon Mori Chami. What does Mori Chami mean? My father-in-law, my shver, Reb Shachna Shein. Shein means Sheyichya Netzach, he should live forever. So the Rama is quoting his father-in-law, Reb Shachna. And some assume that that means that the Rama married the daughter of Reb Shachna. And that would mean that the Rama not only is the main student of this greatest rabbi in Poland, but he is the son-in-law as well. Now, there's a problem over here if you look in the... if you look in one of these articles that in Sinai, in volume 107, there's an article written by Meir Raffler, where he points out that if you look in the manuscript editions of the Rama, nowhere does it say that Reb Shalom Shachna was the father-in-law of the Rama. It says Mori V'Rabbi Reb Shalom Shachna, not Mori Chami. So we don't know it's his father-in-law. That's like a detail for historians. I don't think this is important at all. I don't think that's important at all, but it's a detailed bit of information. Rama is in Poland. Rama is born, we're not sure when, between the years of 1525 and 1530 he was probably born. We really don't know when the Rama is born. The Rama learns first with his father. His name is Ramosha Isserlish. Isserlish is a shortened version of Israel, which is Yisrael. Yisrael, and the Lish is Lazarus. Right? His father, the Rama's father, is Reb Yisrael Lazarus. And he begins his introduction to Darkei Moshe, Ishu Bekraka Ushimo Yisrael. There was a Jew in Krakow whose name was Yisrael. He's talking about his father. Rama's father is Reb Yisrael Lazarus. And he becomes Reb Moshe Isserlish, short for Yisrael Lazarus. Rama's father was a Talmud Chacham. Rama quotes his father La Halacha in one place that it's usher to add red wine to white wine on Shabbos because of Tzoveya, because that would be dying. The Rama quote, not dying in terms of that you die, but dying in the sense of changing the color of something. The Rama quotes that my father said you can't add red. People do this sometimes, like Pesach time. No, there's like a chumrah to have red wine at the Seder because it reminds us of the blood. No, so some people prefer a white wine, but they'll add a little bit of red to the wine. Rama quotes from his father that is forbidden. Then the Rama quotes, but there are others. The Sefer Yireim assumes it's permitted. Right? So Rama quotes his father, at least in that one place. His father's a Talmud Chacham. More importantly than Rama's father being a Talmud Chacham, is his father is super duper wealthy. His father is one of the two Jews in all of Poland who had rights to do business in Vilna. And he sold shmatas in Vilna. And he got very rich from that.
right? Reb Yisrael, the father of the Rambam, is also a Paranos. That means, in Poland at this time, in addition to rabbinic authority being appointed by the government, there is lay authority that is appointed by the government. There are Paranasim. There were 12 of them in each major community, and 7 in smaller communities. Reb Yisrael is a Paranos in Krakow, and Reb Yisrael also had a role in the Vad Arba Ha'aratzos, in this great group of different communities in Poland and Lithuania. At this point, Lithuania is still considered part of the Vad Arba Ha'aratzos. In 1623, Lithuania breaks apart from the Vad Arba Ha'aratzos. Fine. Rambam is super duper rich. Rambam's father is super duper rich. His mother, also, his mother is a descendant of this Rabbi Yechiel Luria, right? His mother is also super duper rich. Rambam was loaded. Rambam is the only child. He learns with his father when he's young. Then he goes to study by Reb Shalom Shachna. He's very talented. Again, we don't know how old he was, but in the year 1550, the rabbinic position in Krakow opens up, and young Rambam is taken as the rabbi of Krakow. 1552, there is a cholera epidemic in Krakow. Rambam loses his wife, mother, and a kid within 3 months. Okay, so life, you might be very rich, but life isn't so pretty. That's the story of the Rambam. The Rambam, in 1550 already, now, assuming he was born in 1525, that means that he's 25. He's born in 1530, that means he is 20. He's a young kid, a young chap. In already in the year 1530, the Rambam is writing a tshuva. We have a dated tshuva. The last source I have on the page is Shut HaRambam Simen Yud. I don't think we'll have time to get to it later, so we'll just mention it very briefly now. Shut HaRambam Simen Yud is a tshuva that's written to Maram of Padua. Maram of Padua was in Italy. He published a version of the Rambam himself. Then some goy went and published the same thing after. And the Ramah of Padua writes a letter to the Ramah saying, is he allowed to publish the Rambam and steal all of my hard-earned work? Basically, this is called intellectual property. This is the source in Jewish law for copyright law. The copyright discussion begins here. Shut HaRambam Simen Yud. Rambam writes this tshuva. He's either 25 or 20 years old. This is the first tshuva he wrote in 1550. He was chief rabbi of Krakow already. 1553, the Rambam remarried. He married a wealthy girl, and the Rambam dies in the year 1572. That's the basic story of the Rambam. He did not live very long. It could be he lived only 42 years. And yet, the Rambam was extremely productive. Not only did he write some of the major works of Halacha, there's a book called Toras Chatos that the Rambam wrote, which is on Shulchan Aruch Yerideya. That was actually the first Halacha work that he wrote. It was all the laws of like a kosher kitchen. Fine. Then he wrote a book, Toras HaOla, which is philosophy based on the Rambam's Mor Nevuchim. Then he wrote works on Kabbalah. Then he wrote works on Parshanut. Okay. Then he wrote a commentary on Megillas Esther 1 year on Purim to send his father as Mishloach Manos. Right. The Rambam did a lot of interesting writing on various and sundry topics. That's the Rambam. Fine. Now, when it comes to how the Rambam did halacha and what made the Rambam unique, at first the Rambam is very similar to the Beis Yosef. Remember, Beis Yosef is writing this long, expansive work on the Torah to try to bring down all of the sources. Rambam tells us that he did the same thing. Rambam was working on a commentary on the Torah. That's what he was doing. And here, in his introduction to the Darkei Moshe, right, first he tells you about his father. It's just interesting what he notes about his father. Ish who bekrakel shmo Yisrael, that's his father, asher nadvarucho bana beis kineses la'el, who built a shul to God. If any of you have been in Krakow, there's something called the Ramoshul. The Ramoshul was built that year, 1552, when the Ramo's mother, wife, and kid died. Right? So the Ramo's father gave money to build a shul. The shul burned down shortly after, was rebuilt. Right? It's interesting that Rama, in writing about his father, writes that he built a shul. There's also some tradition that the Rama wrote a Sefer Torah himself, which was supposed to be a very exact version of the Sefer Torah, and he corresponded with Rabbi Yosef Karo, who was in Sfat at this time, about the exact text of all the words in the Sefer Torah. And this Sefer Torah was kept in the Rama shul, and it was used until the Nazis, Yimach Shemam, right? We lost that Sefer Torah in 1940. We don't know what happened to it after. Right? But that Sefer Torah was like the prized possession in the Ramosha in Krakow. Or Kazmiris, as we should say. Fine. So now, the... by the way, and the Ramo calls his father that he was a Parnas Hinhig V'Kilkel Doro Kikuti El, that his father was a Parnas who supported the people. So then the Ramo says, I began writing a work on the Beis Yosef, Ubehagiyatar Esther. When it came the time for Esther, there's a play on the words in Megillas Esther, Ritzon Olam Isor Beheter Behitzchalti Hilchos Chala. When I began to write the laws of Chala, Achazani Platzos Olav Shani Chal Chala B'Shaminer Yisrael Rosh Hagola Ari Misvacho Allah El Hashamay Berach Elohim Kadishin B'Chofni Asaf V'Chiber Sefer Beit Yosef Asher Korav Yedu Onet Malotav V'Tuvo V'Rov Tuvatzafun D'Kirbo. Basically, he says, I'm writing Hilchos Chala, and suddenly I begin to tremble because I see this book called the Beis Yosef. He's doing exactly the same thing I tried to do. So he says, I'm going to stop writing the work. So he planned on stopping. But then he realized that, you know what, maybe stopping isn't the best idea because his work is better than the Beis Yosef, poo-poo on you. Why? Because the Beis Yosef, he says, too long-winded, my work is a little bit shorter. The Beis Yosef doesn't quote the later Ashkenazic authorities. He does quote the later Ashkenazic authorities. And that is reasons 1 and 2 that we have over here. And let's turn to the second side of the page. Hashlishis v'hu ha'ikar. The third and main reason why he has to maintain his work, right, is v'hu ha'tachlis ha'mevukash b'zeh ha'mechkar. This is the desired goal. Ki yadua sharaf ha-mechaber Beit Yosef b'tiv'o el ha-gdolim nechsaf. He strives to the only the great ones. Hu pasak halacha b'chol makom pishnei u'shlosha edem. He always paskins like 2 out of 3 people, right? That's what he said before. Heim ha-gonim ha-nechmadim. Rif Rambam v'rash b'chol makom sh'shneim hem l'dat echa nitzmadim. Whenever 2 of them agree, he paskins that way. U'lesharab v'asa adirei ha-tara lochash aleihem. He doesn't care about anyone else. Rapi makom gedolim amad lufsok halacha kidevei shneihem. He only wants to pass like 2 out of the big 3. He doesn't care about the others. V'afki him kamay v'lo basray. Velochash lidvarim shetzvachu bal kamay de kamay, hello harif shepasak sof perik basra de erivin, viskimo imo rabim, lifso kalacha bachomakom kid basroi, velochush lidivre kamay. This is a fundamental reason why the Ramah does not like Beis Yosef. Says the Ramah, because we have a rule that hilchasa kibasroi, that the halacha follows the later opinions rather than the earlier opinions, no? And Rif, Rambam, and Rush are earlier opinions. The later opinions are the Tosfos and the Arzaruah and the Rabbeinu Yerucham and that whole group of poskim that the Rambam marshals. And he says we have a rule that we follow the later opinions instead of the earlier opinions. And that rule is said by none other than the Rif. The Rif, who's one of the 3 people that Beis Yosef based on, says the Rav Hilchos Kibasroi. You know why the Rif says this? The Rif says this in the last parak in Erevin, the last Rif in Erevin, in fact. There's a discussion about whether you can allow to use a door knocker on Shabbos, no? Hashma Askol. So, the Rif says, well, the Yerushalmi says it's permitted. Bavli says it's forbidden. Who do I pass him like? In the dispute between Talmud Bavli and Talmud Yerushalmi? Bavli. Why? Hilchasa Kibasroi. Because you follow the later one. Why do I follow the later one? I follow the later one because presumably the later guys saw the earlier guys and consciously decided to reject them. Therefore, says the Rif, we're passing the Bavli over the Yerushalmi, because Yerushalmi is written by Rav Yochanan. That's like what we call first generation Amoraim. Bavli is written by Ravina Rav Ashi. That's fifth generation, let's say. No? So we pass in like the later people, not like the earlier people. That's what the Rif says. And says the Ramah, I'm going to apply the same methodology to not only to the two Talmuds, but I'll apply this methodology to Poskim, to the halachic authorities from his day and age, and will follow the later opinions. Now, this is a very dangerous argument, isn't it? This is a dangerous argument to make. If I say that you always follow the later opinions, so that... What?
We should use computers now.
A, we should use computers. B, right, everything the Ramos says could be thrown out by the next guy. Right? I don't think anyone thinks that they're going to be the last person on planet Earth. Right? In other words, if I follow this rule of Hilchos HaKibasra, so then I really... Right? The Ramos is saying, well, I got a paskin like the... later opinions. Therefore, I'll reject what the Beis Yosef said. Now, the Shach in Chosh and Mishpat in Simon Chafei, commenting on this Ramah, where the Ramah says the same idea of a halacha, the Shach says, well, obviously, you can't say Hilchos HaKibasra if there's a huge gap between the people. Meaning to say, just like the Tanoim and Amoraim, the Amoraim couldn't argue on the Tanoim, because we assume that there's a huge gap between them. So also, you can't argue on people who are out of your league. So we'll only say Hilchos HaKibasra if you're in your league. Of course, this sort of begs the question, but
you know when you say
methodologically, the Ramah is making an interesting point. Mechaber and Ramah. The Beis Yosef says you follow the majority. He happens to determine majority based out of a majority of three. So two out of three wins. The Ramah says, fundamentally, I don't follow majority, I follow the later opinion. That's a very important halachic statement that the Ramah is making, which is what compels the Ramah to write his work, according to the Ramah himself. That's what he has in the introduction.
So
Perhaps. I mean, again, I guess you have to follow the majority of the later opinions. If there's a... Right, all we care about is the later opinions, assuming, by the way, that later opinions saw the earlier ones. If the later opinions didn't see the earlier ones, then you dismiss the later opinions, because presumably they would have agreed with the earlier ones had they seen it. Now...
This is Darkei Moshe, this is the Ramah.
Darkei Moshe is the Ramah, same person.
This is Darkei Moshe you're talking about?
Correct. The Darkei Moshe says, I decided to rate my work because Shulchan Aruch, the Beis Yosef is not a correct work lahalacha because he doesn't follow this rule of Hilchos HaKibasra. There is a huge literature on Hilchos HaKibasra. Hilchos HaKibasra is a principle that is not found in the Talmud at all. No? Hilchos HaKibasra is found in the Gaonim first. Hilchos HaKibasra as... when the Gaonim said it, they drew a line between Abayi and Rava. We only say Hilchos HaKibasra after Abayi and Rava, not beforehand. Why this is true, there's a whole literature about. But the Kitzer, this is one point about Hilchos HaKibasra. Now, point two about Hilchos HaKibasra. We mentioned the Ramah's two great predecessors, Reb Yaakov Palak and Reb Shalom Shachna. And we mentioned that they never wrote anything. Why didn't they write anything? Because they felt Hilchos HaKibasra will always follow the later opinion, and it ain't worth writing anything because it's always going to be thrown out by the next guys. The Ramah, interestingly, agrees with his Rebbe about Hilchos HaKibasra, but he still felt that there's a value in writing. Why? Because apparently... Why did I think that was their thought process? Because in the Tshuvas HaRamah Simen Chaf Hei, he quotes Reb Shalom Shachna's son writing about his father, writing about Reb Shalom Shachna and saying that line. This is not my discovery. This is Shofet Menachem Elon points this out in the Mishpat Ivri. Whatever, I could tell you the page. I have it somewhere in my notes. Fine. Okay. So that is one issue. Next issue. Okay, so now we're talking about the Rama as author of a work on the Tur, the work that's called Darkei Moshe. If you look in these editions of the Tur, in every edition of the Tur, you have Darkei Moshe in the bottom of the page. In the very back, you have something called the Darkei Moshe Ha'aruch. The Darkei Moshe Ha'aruch is the book that he was planning on writing, and basically stopped when he got to when he realized that the Beis Yosef was written. And then he decided, I'm going to finish it anyway. Darkei Moshe HaKatzer, the little Darkei Moshe we have on the bottom, it's unclear historically who wrote that. Some assume the Rama himself wrote it, because he realized that his Darkei Moshe HaAruch was too long. Others assume, Chaim Chernovitz assumes that the Rama himself wrote it. That's what he has in his Toldos HaPoskim. Others assume that the Darkei Moshe HaKatzer was written by the printers. And therefore, you should give absolutely no halachic credibility to the Darkei Moshe HaKatzer. It's very important, but not for now. Okay, let's go on. Shulchan Aruch. Rabbi Yosef Karo writes Shulchan Aruch. Rama gets Shulchan Aruch. He decides, I'm going to write notes on it. Why does the Rama do this? The Rama does this because the Rama feels that this Shulchan Aruch is a terrible work. Why is it a terrible work? It's a terrible work because he is ignoring the psukim of Tosfos. Tosfos and that whole school. Tosfos, Ramban, Or Zeruah, etc. Just like the Maharshal felt. But unlike the Maharshal, who writes his whole long, very long work, right? And he says that this is also not a work for halacha, it's just a work to show you how to do halacha, not how to paskin halacha. The Rama writes a shorter work on the Shulchan Aruch. He just makes these comments. We don't do this. Anu lo nohagim kein. Right? The Rama is following the minhag of Ashkenaz, and he's bringing the minhag of Ashkenaz down into the Shulchan Aruch. Because the Rama incorporates it in Shulchan Aruch, that's how Shulchan Aruch becomes accepted. Now, and that's what the Rama writes in his introduction to Shulchan Aruch. I just want to make like 2 points about the Rama. I realize it's getting a little bit late. This is the Rama proper, the Rama in his notes on Shulchan Aruch. The Rama's notes on Shulchan Aruch is called the Mapa. Mapa is like a tablecloth. Shulchan Aruch is set table. But you have a tablecloth that goes on top of it. That's the Rama. So, he says, Amar Moshe, the son of Yisrael. Shulchan Aruch is a great book. Fine. And then he writes, here, below the Hashulchan, without my comments, Hashulchan Asher Hu Arach Lefnei Hashem Lo Nitano Adayin Lefnei Adam. Just reading the part that I underlined, the table that he made, people couldn't use Hashibim Dinot Elo. People in our countries couldn't use Asher Rubei Min Hagem Dinot Elo Lo Nahigin Kavosei, because we do not follow most. Our practice is not like what he wrote. His practices are based on his majority, 2 out of 3. We have different practices. Our practices are based on the Tosfos. Now, why is it for the Rama that we follow Tosfos and we don't follow the Rambam and the Rif? The Maharshal told us what he thought. Maharshal said, because Rambam and Rif are smarter and bigger. No? God. Tosfos, right? Maharshal said, because Tosfos is smarter and bigger. Right? Gadol b'chachma u'b'minyan. But look at what the Rama writes. I underlined it, and it's in bold. Asher anu mi b'nei b'neihem. We are their descendants, their children. We are children of Tosfos. Tosfos lived in Germany and France. We, Jews in Poland, descend from those in Germany and France. That's what the Rama is saying. And, interestingly, the Rama holds that minhagim are genealogical. No? You know who opposed the Rama on this point? Rabbi Yosef Karo. Joseph Davis, in his article about the Shulchan Aruch, which is found in American Jewish Studies, Volume 26, points out that Rabbi Yosef Cairo, when he was in the Ottoman Empire, when he was in Andronople or something, so Rabbi Yosef Cairo wrote an essay then. He says, I don't understand. There are some shuls in this community that they daven according to Ashkenazic rites. This is a terrible thing, says Rabbi Yosef Cairo, because now you're in Sephardic territory and you became Sephardim. Rabbi Yosef Cairo holds that minhagim are geographical. Right? In other words, if the Ramah is saying, we follow Tosfos. Why? We are not living in Germany and France anymore. That was Tosfos' territory. I'm not living there, but genealogically, we descend from them. The Mechaber, Rabbi Yosef Cairo, in that Tshuva and Avkas Rocha, in his Tshuva Sefer, he says, no, sir. Right? Minhagim are not genealogical, they are geographical. If you live in an area, for example, right? Let's assume that Washington Heights is predominantly Minhag Ashkenaz people. You should not be allowed to daven Nusach Sfarad in Washington Heights. Right?
It's silly.
I don't know if it's silly or not. It's a halachic issue that has
to... There's so many different shuls.
Right, so again, and that's what was going on in Andrianople when Rabbi Yosef Cairo was there. And he was upset, how come there are 19 different shuls in my town? Right? When everyone should be davening the same way. Because he felt... Now, there's also another fundamental difference, which is that Rabbi Yosef Cairo is pushing, based on his messianic ideas that we spoke about last week, he's pushing for unification of halacha. He wants halacha to be a single thing. When halacha is a single thing, Mashiach is going to come. The Ramah, Rabbi Moshe Isserlish, is saying, you know what? I don't want unity. I want...
diversity.
I want everyone to keep on doing what they used to do. Right? In other words, when the Ramah is saying the minhag in these countries, he's saying, yeah, and I want somebody else in a different country to write the minhagim in that country. And there were such people. Reb Yaakov Kashtero wrote the minhagim of Mitzrayim. Egypt had different minhagim than Sfat. There is a book, Erech Lechem, which is Hagos on the Shulchan Aruch, from a Sephardi perspective, taking Rabbi Yosef Cairo to task. How come you are unifying halacha, expecting everyone to do this, and you're ignoring our local practices in Egypt? No? Local practice, remember, this is something when Reb Aryeh Leib Steinman spoke in Breuer's like 5 years ago. So, people didn't pick up on this. He said over a vort that the Lubavitcher Rebbe has, but he sort of just like hit it. He got up there, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, actually his grandfather, was Rebbe Avram David Lavut, and he wrote a book, Shar HaKolo. The Shar HaKolo basically is saying that Nusach Ari is a very important Nusach, because there are 12 different Nuschos HaTefillah in the world, 12 different rites of prayer, right? Every Shevet has their own rite, and if you don't know what Shevet you're in, so you daven Nusach Ari. That's what he says. So when Reb Steinman came to Breuer's, he spoke about how every Shevet has their own rite, their own way of davening, and you should maintain your own rite of davening. It's very funny. He's in Breuer's. He's saying over Lubavitcher Vart. Right? Okay.
You
should maintain your own thing if you know what it is. You don't know what it is, then daven Lubavitcher. Right? That's like...
The big T's.
Right? That's basically where it comes from. Fine. Now, so the Ramah is doing a few things. The Ramah is fundamentally championing Ashkenazi Minhag, but his reasoning is because Anu Mibnei Benehen. A general issue is that in Ashkenaz, and this is what Jacob Katz always points out, Ashkenaz took Minhagim much more seriously than Sfarad. Right, Jacob Katz has a book called Olam Kiminhago Noheg. Right? Nohag, what people do, is an Ashkenazi thing. Fine. So that is another issue to talk about within the Ramah and his approach to halacha. The Ramah in his approach to halacha did not quote sources, just like the Shulchan Aruch did not quote sources. It just tells you, this is the din, this is the din, this is the din. The Ramah's goal is to tell you, don't think this is the din, I can tell you in our countries, this is the din. But he also doesn't give sources. And some people took the Ramah to task for that. The Maharal of Prague had a brother, he's probably dead by now. The Maharal of Prague's brother was called Chaim, right? He wrote a book, Vikuach Mayim Chaim, and he attacked the Ramah for this. We're not quoting sources. He attacked the Rambam for one other thing, and this will be the last point that we make. And this is something that people from outside of our Orthodox movement, they use the Rambam in completely wrong sort of ways. So let's go slowly. Rambam is very different than Shulchan Aruch. You see, in Shulchan Aruch, you go through the Mechaber, Rav Yosef Cairo, you will never once see that the halacha is like this, but in a situation of hefsed meruba, then you do this. In the situation of considerable loss, then you do something else. You will never see that in Rabbi Yosef Cairo's work. It doesn't exist. Rama does this every day. Every other page in Hilchas Kashrus, you see, hefsed meruba, we do this. For example, the Rama has like a strange chumrah that if I have a pot cover that is a little bit pointy, and the steam, and I put the, even if it's anal benyomo, even if I haven't used that cover in 24 hours, it's a pointy pot cover, I put it on the pot of the other type, all the food becomes treif. But in Hefsin Ruba, the Rambam says I could be makol. If it's Friday afternoon, I could be makol. Right? So Rambam gives us more complicated sorts of rules. He says, late Friday, you could be makol, you need the food to cover Shabbos, considerable loss, you could be makol. And the Rambam, in his introduction to his work on Kashrus and the Taurus Chatos, he tells us why he did this. He says, because fundamentally the halacha is lahakil. The halacha is that we're lenient. But out of derech eretz, out of respect for the stricter opinions, we are generally strict, but the stricter opinions wouldn't want us to be strict if it would mean financial loss. That's what the Rambam says, and that's why the Rambam is makol in situations of hefsed meruba, in cases of loss. That's why the Rambam is lenient. Now, the Vikuach Mayim Chayim, the Maharal of Prague's brother, gets very upset. He jumps up and down, he spits wood and nickels. He says, you're going to be lenient in situations of considerable loss. Every mitzvah and darnishtik, some guy's going to come up over to you and say, this is considerable loss. And therefore, you're really always going to be makel, you'll never be machmir. And he got really upset at this. Okay? This, now, so, the Rambam defended what he meant. Obviously, and it could be that Rambam had certain objective guidelines for what hefsed meruba is. It could be it meant a third of your total estate. That's a discussion in Hilchos Treifos. That's one issue that the Bikuach Mayim Chaim has. The next issue the Bikuach Mayim Chaim has is he says, Rambam, you're writing about minhagim. Well, the minhagim that you write about are only the minhagim in Poland where you live. But I live in Germany now, says the Maharal of Prague's brother, and your little crack, El Kazmires Minhagim, don't apply to me. So the Rambam writes back, and he says, well, tell me, what language do we speak in Poland? Answer, Yiddish. What language do you speak in Germany? Answer, Yiddish. Says the Rambam, I am writing a work for everyone who speaks Yiddish. Right? That is what the Rambam is basically saying in his response to the Vikuach Mayim Chayim, at least the way it's quoted by the printers. Wow. Now, that is very, very interesting. You see, codification of halacha is always a way of defining boundaries. This time period, 1530s through 1600s, the time period everything is going on, no? Is also a time that for the first time in British law, let's say, there's beginning to have codification. Wales used to be very separate from England. Wales accepted British common law and began to write some of the precedents down at this time, based on Henry the whatever, and that meant that Wales lost its identity and integrated into general British society. The making of the Shulchan Aruch, Professor Davis points out, is really an effort in defining our boundaries as much as anything else. What is considered an Ashkenazic Jew? Is an Ashkenazic Jew a Jew who lives in Germany? Is an Ashkenazic Jew a Jew who lives in a country where they speak Yiddish? Am I an Ashkenazic Jew? I live in Frankfurt on the Hudson, I guess, but I don't really live in Germany, and I don't speak much Yiddish. People really speak Yiddish. Tell me I don't speak Yiddish. So, am I an Ashkenazic Jew?
Yes.
It's not, yes, only if I accept a Rambam's definition of Anu Mibnei B'neihem. Right? Reb Chaim, the brother of the Maharal of Prague, says that, you know what, definitions are geographical, and geographical in a narrow sense. The Ramah is hedging, he's going back and forth. Maybe the definition is genealogical, maybe the definition is linguistic. Now, when I mentioned that people misunderstand the Ramah, I was referring to, there's an article by Judith Hauptmann during the whole controversy in the conservative movement about ordaining openly gay rabbis. So she wrote as follows, that it's time for someone to pull an Israelis, that's her expression, to act like the Ramah does. And just like the Ramah writes that in our countries we don't practice that, and therefore the law is different, so also we need a rabbi of great stature to get up and say, we don't practice that, therefore the law is different. This is terrible amoratus. This is just, I mean, more than anything else, just the Ramah was never saying anything like that at all. Terrible amoratus, but that's what she writes. Thank you very much for coming.